Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
You know, the cookbook is the album, right? It's like, oh, it's that one track that you loved, and like, now I'm going to find that artist and get into their album. We love that, and we love the creative possibilities of that, and we love the creative possibilities of what happens when someone can be with you for hours, hell, a lifetime, rather than, hey, I really love that video, and then like flicked my thumb and I was watching another video.
This is Taste. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. Korea World is here. It's a new cookbook I wrote with Dookie Hong, and we are dedicating a week of episodes to the Korean foods movement all around the globe. To kick things off, we are catching up with Francis Lam, editor-in-chief of Clarkson Potter and host of The Splendid Table. Francis is our editor, man, and he's my coworker, and I just love this guy. I've known him for years, and we speak about how we collaborated on the book. We also hear about Francis's journey through journalism, including working in TV, in radio, and at the legendary Gourmet magazine. We also talk about his New York Times column. It was one of my favorite bits of writing he's ever done. And we talk about the process of bringing these stories of local New Yorkers cooking in their home kitchens to life. It's so great having Francis in the studio, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Francis Lam, welcome to This Is Taste. We've never had done this before.
I walk by you every day in the office, but yeah, I finally get entered into your lair, so thanks a lot.
I know, it's like kind of different to have a guest who works here, but also somebody I just like have known for a long time. You are mine and Dookie's editor for two cookbooks and a friend, and I respect you, and let's talk about some stuff. I mean, we're doing Korea World Week, and we're going to get to the book, but hey man, where have you been going out to eat right now? Like anything good that you've been thinking about?
You know, I could have had a better answer to this before I had a kid.
Yeah.
So now it's like, oh, you know, that pizza place and
right.
The falafel shop, and it's not even that good of a falafel, but it's fast and it gets here quick. In New York, it's funny because I've only actually eaten there once, but I've like in my mind eaten there 600 times, and that's Damaka. You know, it won a Beard Award a couple years ago, but it really, like, at that memory of that meal, just like every time, like, oh, let's go somewhere. My first thought was like, can we go to Damaka?
Yeah.
Can we go to Damaka? So Damaka is this really terrific, sort of multi-regional Indian restaurant, opened by this company called Unapologetic Foods, which, you know, their name is right in the title, right? So, and you've had them on the show.
Chintan's been on the show. We'll link to the show notes. It's a great, great conversation about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're just like, I love the story. The story was like, you know, they had Indian restaurants here in New York that were a little more sort of geared to like what they thought the market wanted and wasn't going that great. And when they're like, if we're going to go down, let's just go down swinging. Let's just make the food that like I miss from home exactly the way that I would eat it there. And it it worked.
Yeah, it really worked.
You can't get in.
Now he's got Rowdy Rooster. He's got Masala Wala in Park Slope, which is also hard to get. I mean, it's all hard to get into.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Restaurant.
And the food is terrific. So that's definitely a place I have in mind. And I've been going to sort of revisiting old sort of childhood favorites and just exploring in Chinatown more. So I grew up in New Jersey. My parents worked in Chinatown like all through when I was a kid. And so I had my only relationship to New York City was really with Chinatown. Like that's all I knew of the entire city, which is sort of funny now that I think back on it. But you know, I haven't spent a lot of time there as an adult. I actually also worked in Chinatown for a few years when I first moved to New York.
Oh, where? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I worked at a nonprofit there.
Oh, right on.
And we had an office, and that was where our office was. And
so, what were the lunch spots when you were working nonprofit? Like, were you going in and?
I mean, this was literally 20 some odd years ago.
And why Noodletown was around then, right? 20 years ago.
Oh yeah, that place is old. The hills.
Yeah.
I didn't really go there that much. No disrespect to it, but to me, it was always like the Chinatown place for people who didn't really want to walk into Chinatown because it's like it's on the Bowery. You can get to it.
Of course.
Without really being like in the thick of Chinatown, so I was a little bit like. Oh, okay, y'all don't really know.
I love it.
So I had
it.
Like a little snotty attitude about it. But whatever. So I would go to different places. Lately I've been going to this place called Noodle Village, which is like the noodles there and the wontons are very Hong Kong style. And something I've grown to be interested in New York was, for me, it used to be like, oh, how close does it taste to Hong Kong? That's where my family's from. And that's where I used to visit as a kid. And so the closer something tasted to like what I would get in Hong Kong, like, the better it was in my mind. And now I see it in a little bit of a different lens, which is it's not about how close to Hong Kong does it taste, but how much does it, to me, feel like Chinatown? Like, does it feel like this place?
Are you reflecting on these restaurants of your youth kind of in the preparation or in the writing of your memoir? I know you're working on something.
I'm working on a book. It's not exactly a memoir.
Okay, good.
But yeah, it is about my relationship to Chinatown.
That's exciting, man.
And, you know, it came to be because like I said, I have a child, I have a daughter, and like, I speak Cantonese. I speak it okay. I used to speak it very well, like to the point where, you know, I would talk to people and they would think I was from Hong Kong. And that language has kind of like faded for me a little bit. You throw me back in Hong Kong, give me a couple of weeks and most of it will come back. But anyway, like that's my culture. Like that's what I grew up in. That's one of my native languages, you know, that in English. And one day I was like looking at my kid and being like, well, she doesn't speak it and I don't know how to teach it to her. You know what I mean?
Like, mm-hmm.
And for me, like, because I was never taught Cantonese.
I
learned to speak it because it was what we spoke in the house. So I was never taught. So I never learned as a student. So I don't know how to teach it.
Right.
And it just got me thinking about like, wow, what does it mean that A, I'm far enough removed from what I think of as my culture that I can't actually impart it to my child? Like, I don't know how to impart my culture to my child. And my wife is Portuguese. Her parents are from Portugal, Portuguese immigrants. She's the daughter of immigrants. And she speaks Portuguese. And we don't really know how to teach our
daughter. It's the same story for your wife. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's this idea of like, what does it mean to be of a culture, to care a lot about it, to love it, to feel like it's part of you, but not feel like you're in it enough to like give it to your kid? So it just got me thinking about what my relationship with Chinatown is like. And so it's not a memoir like, oh, I was born on this day and whatever, whatever. But it's sort of an exploration of like, what does it mean to be from a culture, but kind of feel like you're a little bit outside of it.
I mean, it's a fascinating approach. And I feel like the traditional memoir, the linear memoir, is not what we need in writing. And we're going to segue to your remit at Clarkson Potter, where you run the show as editor-in-chief. But back to just the memoir again, like when you're thinking about these old restaurants, how are you revisiting them? I know like memory is a big part of this book, I'm sure, remembering what used to be there. But are you going to current places and drawing up memories of your time there?
Yeah, so part of it is like about memory, but part of it is like, oh, how do you kind of like re-ingratiate yourself to a neighborhood, a community, like actual people? Like if I walk down the street in town, I don't know people, right? I can't wave to people. I kind of want to be that person. I want to be that person. I can walk around this neighborhood and wave to people. I'm like, oh, hey, how's it going? And then sort of the bigger picture of like, what does it mean to then like re-ingratiate yourself to a culture? When you feel like it's maybe sort of like slipping out of your fingers a little bit.
Do you bring people along the ride? Do you invite guests out in, like from your life? Like people?
Yeah. I mean, like for me, it's like, they're not research trips. It's just like, I just want to like be there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My editor will be horrified to learn that I have not actually done the research in any concerted way, but I kind of feel like part of it is just like living there and being there more often and just kind of feeling it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're writing your story. So, I mean, you're going to obviously do zoom outs and do what editorial tactics are needed to tell the story. But obviously, I'd love just to hear your story. We're going to get your writing, focus a little bit on the New York Times Magazine column you wrote for years, which I was a big fan of. But let's go to Clarkson Potter. And I would like to know, you know, what you and all your colleagues, your wonderful colleagues who are also my colleagues and we share an office, what are you looking to acquire? I think this is like a big question, the million-dollar question or less. if agents are listening, or more if the agents are listening. What do you like? Look, I mean, again, I love what Clarkson Potter does. I've published two books with you. It's just terrific. And so what do you look for in a book?
You know, it's funny to say, what do you look for? Because I don't have a thing I look for. For us, it's really a matter of like, what's the story this author is trying to tell? And it's funny because like we publish a lot of different kinds of books at Potter. But, you know, for the purpose of this conversation, we'll mostly talk cookbooks. And certain cookbooks are a huge, huge part of what we do. But it's funny because the way I talk about what we look for in cookbooks sounds really not that different than any other editor in this building would talk about. It's like, what's the story? Like, that's the first thing I care about. What's the story? Who is the author trying to tell this story? Why are they the person to tell this story? Like, these are all sort of cliches you've heard before, but it's really true for us. And by that, I mean, literally sometimes I mean, cookbooks have a story. And for, I mean, I guess listeners of this podcast will certainly understand that because, you know, you're nerdy enough to listen to this podcast, like food nerdy enough to listen to this. But, you know, for a lot of the general public, like they still think cookbooks are just, oh, it's like, it's, you know, pages of recipes stapled together. Like, okay, cool. Like I could Google the recipes. I could spend money buying the cookbook. Sort of either way, it doesn't really matter. But people who actually care and want to buy a cookbook or want to like be immersed in the world of a cookbook, which is really what I think about, there has to be a story. And maybe that story is narrative, like a literal story with characters. We just published a book called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts. That is, it's a little bit genre bending, honestly, but it has 40 recipes. It's, you know, beautifully shot, like gorgeous photos, but it's written by the literal poet laureate of Kentucky, who's written award-winning novels and poetry. And it's like this blend of memoir, family history, going back five generations of Black Appalachia. And, you know, to some degree, fiction. She like imagines conversations her great-great-great-great-grandmother had, which obviously
I mean, she's a novelist too, and she writes incredible fiction as well, which is amazing.
Yeah. She's amazing. Crystal Wilkinson.
Yeah, right. And Crystal has been on the show, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, she's incredible. So like that's a book that we publish. So very literally a story. Or, you know, Korea World or Koreatown, its predecessor. Like the story I felt you guys were telling in Koreatown, for instance, was, yes, it's a Korean cookbook, but it's not just a collection of greatest hits of Korean cuisine, right? It's specific to what is the Korean cuisine that you find in Korean American communities or in, you know, or the cuisine that was inspired by that experience of the of Korean culture, right? Not necessarily of Korea itself, but it's the folks who came largely in the 70s and 80s who established these neighborhoods. Again, you know, the biggest one in LA, but there's one in New York and all around the country, you know, and how the food there is distinct in its own story. Like that's what I mean by the story of a cookbook. And, you know, obviously we'll talk about Korea World in a minute too, but sort of applying that lens to, okay, what's actually being cooked and eaten in Korea today? And how does that inspiration sort of flow around the world?
Yeah.
So that's what I look for. I look for the story of a book. Like what's exciting and what's the point? Yeah. Because if it is just a collection of recipes between two covers, and you know, honestly, you probably don't need it.
Yeah, you probably don't.
Could
it's,
just
it's not essential unless there's Google. Like some kind of, yeah, Google's going to help you out or Epicurious is going to help you out. I've asked Matt Sartwell this, Concepcion, at Now Serving and Kitchen Arts and Letters, respectively. I've asked Raquel Pelzel, our colleague, New York colleague, Clarkson Potter. I'd like to know, Francis, is there like a wish list of cuisines or cultures or even like could be like a technique or a style of cooking that you're just looking for right now?
You know, it's funny because I think that that used to be much more the key skill, maybe, that you'd say an editor would have. Obviously, you want to be able to work with your author. You want to be able to like help them structure a story, all that stuff. But, you know, what really set editors apart maybe in the past or in the classic sort of understanding of what an editor does is exactly that. I have an idea and I'm going to go out and find the person who's going to write that idea out. You know, that's where we think of like discovery, right? And not to say that's not important still. That's still very important. For us, it's a blend of that though. And I guess what I'm getting to is like that goes back to like sort of the gatekeeping idea of the editor too.
I love that you use that word. I mean, it was certainly the culture of publishing not that long ago, this idea of the gatekeeping.
Yeah, for sure. And it's still there. I mean, it's still part of the DNA, right? Like, you know, the people in this building are the people who like make the books that you're going to read and talk
completely
about.
Completely agree.
You know, et cetera. So like they think of themselves as being like sort of the origin of
but there was this
culture.
Attitude slightly that like we've done enough of this category and it is the law, this like idea that the editor was like this like kind of on the mountain screaming, you know, preaching down to all the people making proposals. And I think from what the work you've done, the work that's been done at 10 Speed Press and many others, it's like you're more flexible with acquisition.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is like at some point, just a sense of humility. It's like,
that's it.
The fact is we have to be as reactive as we are, you know, proactive, right? To some ears, that sounds like, well, that's not cool. Like you're not doing your job. No, our job is also to see what people are doing out there and what people are excited about. So yeah, like I'm not going to lie. Like a lot of our authors that we're really excited about, that we love and we're super proud to publish are like, you know, got their start on social media, you know, and they started, you know, cooking their food and telling their stories and people love what they do. So we want to be able to work with them and like make a book, give them a different way, a different form, a different sort of way of working to like expand what they do beyond your phone and give their fans like a different way to interact with them. So now they go into the world of, you know, Carolina Gellin, for instance, or the world of Justine Duran, just to like pick up, you know, two that we, you know, I was talking about recently, as opposed to having Justine and Carolina show up once a day on your phone while you're scrolling through. Now you can walk into their world for, you know, 200 some odd pages, 300 pages or whatever. And it's a totally different experience. And we're thrilled to be able to be able to do that. But it, like, we didn't invent Justine and Carolina. Like we found them on our phones. Just
and
like
you're
you
giving
did.
The reader. I've said this many times in the show, and I'm so bullish on the industry of cookbooks in this time when food media is in great, you know, change. In that the experience of having Carolina or Molly Baz or Alison Roman or many of the authors you publish, you know, having them in 325 pages in a book is very different from the heavily ad loaded. Once a day TikTok or even the website with all the slow loading times, you get something very unique. And I feel like that experience of reading through their story, cooking through their recipes, cannot be matched in a cookbook. I believe you agree with me.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? It's a little bit like, it's like if your social media feed is a constant mixtape that was not created by humans lovingly for you, it was just like thrown together by the algorithm. You know, the cookbook is the album. Right. It's like, oh, it's that one track that you loved. And like, now I'm going to find that artist and get into their album, you know, like, and so we love that. And we love the creative possibilities of that. And we love the creative possibilities of what happens when someone can be with you for hours, hell, a lifetime, you know, rather than, hey, I really love that video. And then like flicked my thumb and I was watching another video, like literally 1 second later.
Yeah. And it's for $17 on Amazon or 22. It's like such a beautiful
price. Support your local bookstore.
Of course, 35 if you're going to if you're going to any of the wonderful bookstores. I agree. I'm just being pragmatic with our listener, and I think affordable luxury.
Legit. Yeah, for sure.
And I love, like, to quote Drake, it's like album mode. I believe that the authors are coming here for album mode. Francis, I'm using that. I love that. Let's talk about New York Times, your column that you wrote many years at the New York Times Magazine. What I enjoyed so much about it, not just the recipe development, which is always really good, is I think the word intimacy always comes to mind. You got really close to your subjects in a way that's very difficult for a writer, that zoom in, that like really getting a sense of them as a person. You obviously spent time with them as a reporter. And I think this obviously translates to your work at Splendid Table, which your interviews are very intimate. And I want to ask you, you know, getting close to these subjects, either on audio or via reporting, do you feel that is like a little bit of your tactic when reporting?
And just for context for the listener, this is a column I wrote for New York Times Magazine as part of their Eat page, which appears every week in the magazine, but they would rotate through. So basically, I would be there once a month. And it was a column where the assignment for me was to go out into New York City and find a different, normally a home cook, but didn't have to be a home cook, just from a different immigrant community in the city, and get a recipe out of them and put it in the magazine. And what I wanted to do with the 800 words that came before the recipe was pretty much entirely up to me. And for me, it was almost always an opportunity for me to tell a little bit of the story of that person, how they learned this recipe, how they came to this country, why they came to this country, their hopes, their dreams, their fears, and et cetera, et cetera. So for me, when I would start talking to these folks, there's always like some moment in, you know, I might spend a whole day with them. I might spend multiple days with them. I might spend, you know, 3 hours with them. It really just depended. But there was usually a moment where I felt like, okay, you just unlocked something you just unlocked the box. You took something precious out and you put it right in my hand. What I did to earn that trust from you, I don't know, but now I have that trust from you and now it's my job to preserve that trust. It's my job to take that story and put it out in the world in as pure a way as possible because it was shared with me, you know? And that's, you know, what do we have in this life, right? You have your memories and you have your stories.
Yeah.
You know, your things are fleeting, your clothes go out of style, your money disappears. You know, like you have your relationships, you have your story and you have your memories. And if someone has shared one of those things with me, like they shared their story with me, like it's my job.
Yeah.
Just like,
and the beautiful thing about the New York Times is like the archives hopefully aren't going away. Like, you know, it's a well-funded publication. So I'm going to link to the archive of your work on EAT. And I feel like, do you think about this column now that you don't even written it for years, but when you're like in the world, do you think about, oh man, that would be a great column, man? Like, oh,
you know, I don't.
I'd love to.
No, I don't. And one of the things about being a writer is you can never stop working, you know,
like totally.
Your brain's always on. You're always like, what's the next story? So like the fact that I have not written for magazines or papers in a few years now, I mean, occasionally I'll write, a story, but it's not really been a part of like my personality, no. You know, it's actually nice to have it be turned off a little bit. A little bit like I'm friends with a number of restaurant critics. Actually, I'm like texting Ruth Reichel to go out to dinner with her next week, hopefully. But one of the things that, of course, everyone who's into food would like die to be a restaurant critic. And not to take anything away from it, but like on some level, it's like, imagine going to restaurants every night. Amazing. But you're working.
Yes.
Every night. You know, you can't just like hang out and be like, oh, that was great. No, you have to sit there and like, you have to describe every dish in your head as you're eating it. You have to describe the room in your head the whole time as you're eating it. Maybe you can have a conversation with the person across from you.
Maybe
they're there.
If you're lucky.
As a mouth, you know,
it's just like the deadline is, especially for the daily paper critic. I mean, like Rafael Brion is on the Food and Wine Hunt now and he's traveling and his deadline's a little different, but like, these guys like Bill Addison in Los Angeles, I mean, it's ruthless, that deadline.
Yeah, it's the deadline. And also like the mindset you have to have to do the work. Like you
got to do the work.
If you're looking for a story everywhere, that means you're writing a story everywhere you go. So you're always writing in your head. And I'm a little glad to not have that anymore.
Yeah. So it sounds like you had like a little bit of a hard break from writing, which is a beautiful cleansing process, I'm sure, from that, like, you know, always being on anxiety of always having that assignment. Now you've got like, you're running.
I mean,
show,
to be
got...
fair, I loved it. I totally loved it. I'm not like, oh, burn me out.
You're an editorial
like, you know,
guy.
It's like, you know, you just do a different thing now.
Well, now you've got like 50 plus books on your docket. you're running multiple employees. And I think we all talk about you as here at the building and all the other work you do with Splendid Table and some of the television work, it's remarkable, but you obviously love it, Francis. Like this is, you're not doing this because it's like some kind of like persona. This is like in your body. And it probably goes back to when you started working for Gourmet and writing for them.
Yeah. Well, I bring it back to this idea of storytelling.
Yeah.
Right? And like storytelling is always about story finding and story listening. So for me, like as an editor, it's really not that different from being a writer in the sense that I'm not writing the words, thankfully, but I'm helping someone tell their story, which again, like what I was saying before with the column, like I don't think of that as my column that I wrote, you know, sui generis, genius, godhead, you know, like, it was like, I went and made, you know, stuffed calamari with this lady in Sheepshead Bay and that's her story.
Yeah.
All I did was help her tell her story to the world.
It's journalism. You're absolutely good segue to Koreatown and Korea World. But let's talk about it. You write in the edits when you're editing our manuscript. Some of those bubbles got a little bit big, buddy.
Yeah.
I love it though. I mean, there's many different ways to edit a manuscript. Sometimes it's light, sometimes it's heavy, sometimes it's phone calls, sometimes it's on them. And really, I think you blended all of it. But really, your editing is really a legendary, you know, moment for anyone in books. If you get a Francis Lam edit to speak about you in the third person, apologize. Let's go back to July 12th, 2013. I'm sitting in literally Koreatown. It's weird. It was just serendipitous. I was having a coffee. I was working in the neighborhood at the time and happened to be there. It was the morning and my agent, Angela Miller, writes me a very short email. She's a very short emailer. And she wrote me, as you know, I'm sure. But she wrote me that she had heard through the grapevine, it wasn't from you, that you were interested in acquiring Koreatown. and changed my life forever. So thank you, and just want to recognize the moment. And I want to ask you about thinking, and I don't want to get too much into talking about us as our editorial work. I want to talk about more of the larger project of Koreatown and Korea World and what it stands for. But a little behind the scenes, you know, this book, when we took it out in 2013, I don't think I've ever told you this, it was rejected by most. I think we had two offers, you and another major house. But it was, you were the only one when we took the meeting with Doris Cooper and Dookie and I and Angela, you were the only one who had meticulous notes throughout the manuscript. Little stickies were sticking out from the pages, and I was like, this is a good sign. And then the meeting itself just went through, and you were clearly engaged with the content. But I want to ask you, what drew you to the project at the time when everyone literally was saying Korean food is a niche, Korean food is a trend, Korean food is going away? These are all like literal quotes that happened, and disappointingly, we received from our inbox.
Well, I didn't know that.
I don't think I've told you that.
That sucks.
It wasn't a bid on book, buddy. And I've had other books that have been. Yeah. It was not like we were like sweating it out a little bit, I would say.
And now look. Look at us.
Look at us look now. At us. No, buddy. I don't want it to be about
New York Times bestseller. Look at us.
Look at us. Well, that was when the New York Times was different.
Well, yeah, but hey,
it's earned out.
It hit the list.
It hit the list and it's earned out.
Hit the time bestseller list.
I feel very proud of that, and it actually commercially has sold a lot of copies. But I want to know what you saw in Korean food in 2013. Very different.
It's funny. I saw it a really different way than how you're describing it. In the sense that, to me, what really stood out about it wasn't that it was a Korean cookbook. To me, what stood out about it was that it was an American cookbook. And your original working title wasn't Koreatown, which is what ended up being the actual title. It was Koreatown USA. And I remember that very specifically because that drew me in. I was like, okay, what are we getting at here? And again, I don't want to bore folks because I already gave you my capsule description of it earlier. You know, to me, it was the fact that it was about these immigrant communities, and it was about how the food sort of works in these immigrant communities, of course, like how delicious it is, how to make it. I love the fact that you guys shot this book in this very sort of journalistic style. You had a great photographer like traveled with you.
Sam
you
did Ryan.
Both, yeah, you did it with both books with Alex Lau doing Korea World. But yeah, it was like you wanted to shoot the food as it's really served in these restaurants and as it's really served in these food courts and in these grocery stores. And again, overall, to me, it felt like, oh, we're telling the story of what happens in immigrant communities in America. The fact that if you came and you know, if the book was, you know, Little Tokyo, USA, if the book was, Chinatown, USA or whatever, I think it would have been just as excited in the sense that that's, to me, it was the second part of that working title.
Yeah.
It was about like, how does this food work in America? And what does that tell us about being American?
Yeah, I think, thanks for pointing out the American part. It was certainly fundamental in our book. And the way Dookie and I, when we were working on the proposal, I mean, thinking about the Korean diaspora in 2013, you know, this is before the quote unquote Korean wave had fully hit, you know,
yeah,
the
for sure.
cultural wave of like, you know, things like Parasite, things like K-pop. You know, we're not talking about that in 2013. We're talking about kimchi tacos. And unfortunately, the kimchi taco was kind of like the headline for a lot of Korean food and also barbecue. And what we did with that book with Koreatown and slightly what we're continuing with Korea World is there's more than that. You know, this is a diaspora that immigrated to America in the 70s and 80s. It was extremely strong and it was in cities that we knew and it was always there, but it really wasn't being written about in a way that we thought was telling the story of immigration of the American part of the book.
Right. And for sure, like it went deep on like Korean culture. Like, I love learning about it.
Yeah.
I love like, you know, and yeah, I remember like how many times you and Dookie and it would be like, you know, it's more than barbecue. We really want people, but here's galbi. You know,
I know.
Here's a killer galbi.
Here's a great. I mean, his
here's a great bulgogi.
His galbi is still like that. That I use that recipe every summer when I do galbi for backyard barbecue. I still use japchae, and I still cook a lot from Koreatown. Let's segue to Korea World, and
yeah.
I would like to get your take. Just generally, we're talking this week all about it, and we're having all the members of the team and many from who are featured in the book on Taste. And This Is Taste. Tell me, you know, you're allergic to sequels. Like, we don't do them in cookbooks. And this somehow, our proposal spoke to you, and we were very thankful that we could continue the story. Not well, a sequel, funny. Francis.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I totally remember the very first email you sent about it. It's not a sequel. It's not a sequel. Like, pick me, pick me.
I know.
But no, I mean, like, no, sequels are I don't, you know, for whatever reason, a funny phenomenon in cookbooks. Like, people don't like sequels.
Yeah. It's true. Very true.
But, you know, for me, it wasn't a sequel. It was a continuation. Like, that's what I was excited about. The fact that, you know, the first book, well, you guys traveled around this country, around the United States. And for Korea World, the idea is we want to travel around Korea. And, you know, there was so much, you know, I am by no means an expert in Korean cuisine by any stretch. But, you know, I could probably know every item on, you know, your standard typical Koreatown menu, in part because of the book and just from eating in Korean restaurants. And there were so many dishes in this book that were new to me or felt like, oh, this is like a cool evolution of a dish that I've seen before. Like, the one dish I think of all the time is the tteokbokki, which are those like cool chewy rice cakes. And you have like a street food version, which often are like in a gochujang sauce, so the fermented sweet chili soy paste. But this one has like heavy cream in it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
A, that sounds incredible. And B, it's not like, oh, this isn't like some like thing some like chef bro made in like a, you know, in like a cool like Korean inflected French food restaurant. Like, no, right. this is a dude on the streets of Seoul, yeah, because there's like 600 other dudes who are selling that dish. And that's actually what people are eating today. So I thought that was super rad. And I love that like insight into like, yeah, contemporary.
The book
Korean
is filled with those. I mean, like, you know, we talk about the samgyetang tteokbokki, which is like the roast chicken using the flavors of samgyetang, which is a traditional soup or tang. And then there's also like Gilgari toast, street toast that you find throughout the Korea. But also, I feel like the book, one thing, we went to Jeju Island and, you know, we were trying to write about Jeju cuisine in a way, not in like, it isn't a book about Jeju, but we tried to capture some things. And like finding this like rockfish that was whole fried, but then smashed by the owner of the restaurant, this like smashing technique with a gochujang lacquer that felt fresh to me. So I'm previewing the book a little bit. If this is the only episode you listen to, you can pick up the copy of the book. But when you're looking at the recipes, were there any others that like stuck out in your head that you feel maybe are a little different in terms of the Korean cookbook?
Oh man, this is like this is a test. This is how
this
well,
is
how
literally
well,
you have
how well
50 authors, and you've got, you know, 75 to 150 recipes per each author. This is literally in this year alone, and I'm putting you on the spot to ask you about more. Yeah, unfair question.
I already whipped out the creamy.
No, you already did.
No,
one.
No. There's one another one too that I remember very distinctly. That I mean, there's many of I remember.
No, whatever, but
like one thing about all the time, which is, you know, your whole thing about like Korean food is more than barbecue, and you, let's face it, somewhat dickishly only have one barbecue recipe in this book.
Somewhat.
a little bit fingers up, but
yeah.
But you did like, it's incredible. It's basically like some like incredible child of Korean barbecue, which, you know, typically people like enjoy like grilled on the table over hot coals. You know, thin sliced meats, you grill it fast, you get some color, often like super marinated. But like combines that with like Texas barbecue, which is not marinated, very like just salt and pepper, smoked long and hard, and low and slow, but for a long time. And ideally in like great Texas barbecue, you're really tasting beef and you're really tasting the smoke, but in like a nuanced way, not like a punch you in the face, but like have the smoke be like almost like the aftertaste. And like you have this recipe for like this giant like dinosaur,
yeah, big guy.
Short rib.
Yeah, it's like, and
a mix of smoked and
Korean like, barbecue. It's,
yeah,
it's amazing. That's inspired by a restaurant in Seoul called Mongtan. And I remember our recipe tester did that in like the middle of the winter. So she was, bless her for going out with her green egg in January in New York, but she did it. And you know, she felt the same way as you. It like stuck out as like this hybrid of Texas and Korea. And I really hope people do cook that one. So, buddy, thank you for pulling out a recipe, because we're, you know, you got recipes floating in your head. Oh, I'll just shout out the kimchi granita that goes with that. It's like a really nice pairing that I think is unexpected.
Oh yeah, that was cool. Yeah,
reflects like this. The book is all about modern Korea, and it's about how these recipes are reflected in the modern scene. Because our first book, it is a little bit of an FU to not have a lot of barbecue, but like you can buy Koreatown. We have a lot of we have a lot of barbecue. They look great together. I finally put them both together and married them. Before we get to our final section, I want to ask you about Splendid Table. It's a show that I listened to going back to 1988. I remember leaving Sunday school and listening to Lynn Rosetta Casper talk about all these incredible recipes and worlds that I had not experienced as a young boy. And you took over around 8 years ago, and I just want to ask you about the program. I mean, how do you think about the actual bookings of the interviews week after week? Like at Potter, is there a general theme for what you're trying to do with the work there?
Yeah, the show has really evolved a lot over time. But I think what really kept it consistent before I came on was the personality of Lynn as the previous host. And I adore her, and she was very, very generous with me. We didn't know each other super well, super duper well when I was tapped to take over for her after she retired. But she certainly was a part of that decision, and I'm extraordinarily grateful to her. But I think people loved her her sort of improvisational style. She could talk to anyone. She was a great conversationalist, and she could talk about cooking with anyone. And so and there were sort of segments of the show that were long time favorites. There would often be a segment where a caller would call in and be like, I've got ketchup, 6 eggs, one wedge of lettuce, and 3 pairs of socks in my refrigerator. And Lynn would make dinner out of it. She would imagine a dinner right off the top. There were all these things that people fell in love with her about. So when I took over the show, I was like, well, I can't be her, right? Look, I didn't want people to feel like, oh, this show that they had, to your point, in some cases, grown up listening to. I mean, the show had been around for well over 20 years at that point. I didn't want them to feel like this was a totally different thing. So I was a little bit in a middle place that didn't feel weird. It was entirely, everyone made me feel very comfortable, but it was I know I don't want to be Lynn. I don't want to try to be Lynn, because that would just be, people would be like, you're doing a bad impression of this person. But I also didn't want to be boom, kick the table over. We're doing things this way.
Yeah. Wouldn't have flown with the NPR audience. They would have.
Or we're not even.
Or
well,
any audience.
To be fair, it's not like I had this grand vision that I stopped myself from,
Yeah.
For me, it was a matter of humility. I'm stepping into an institution. I really want to learn how this place works, and I want to be a part of it. And if it evolves naturally because of my presence here, great. But I didn't have a plan. This is what we're doing, guys. And so what you're hearing is sort of evolution. One thing I did know for sure was I wanted the show to really speak to a wide range of subjects, topics, and people. Really wanted to focus on showing the range of what, certainly what American cuisine is and looks like. Sort of like we were talking about with Koreatown. I think of Koreatown as being an American cookbook, not necessarily a Korean cookbook. And so I kind of want that was one of the approaches we took, the Splendid Table. And we talked to people internationally too. That's not exactly my point, but I wanted our show to really reflect who we are as a society. And so, we would have folks on who would talk about, Senegalese tradition. Actually, this wasn't even my segment. This was actually one of Lynn's, but one of my favorite episodes was, a chef, Pierre Chum, who actually, funny enough, now publishes with Clarkson Potter, came and explained the Senegalese tradition of taranga, this idea of taranga, which is this idea of the other being more important than the self, and sometimes translated as hospitality, but it's really deep. It's not just that means be nice to your guests, or offer them a glass of tea or whatever. It's really putting others before you as part of their hospitality tradition. So stories like that really appealed to me. I pulled onto that string.
You really did. I mean, it really did shift tonally. But then, of course, you did, Thanksgiving call-in shows and ones that felt like they were part of the heritage.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Really, you thread the needle at that time. And it was tricky. And you and Sally Swift, your producer, who I know as well, just terrific job just making this continuation. I know you work so hard on the show. And I just really respect what you do. On This Is Taste, we ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, Francis, here's a little rapid fire Fast and Furious Taste Check. Are you ready?
No, I hate these.
I know you do.
With the fire of a thousand suns.
I know.
I'll make things up. Let's go.
I know you do. The best fruit.
Mangosteen.
The worst vegetable.
I don't even mean that. No. Mangoes or peaches.
Thank you for... You are an honest guy. You weren't just saying the thing that sounded good. You were like, mangoes, not mangosteens.
Mangoes or peaches. And
or peaches.
The reason why is, well, mangoes are the king of fruit. And
they
peaches
really
are basically, that's like a domestic mango.
And they're hard to really find.
Goodness. It's a non-tropical mango. Just gotta get a good
I'm going to unpack that and maybe do the article on taste. I feel it's amazing that you just said that. The worst vegetable.
I'm going to get my Southern card revoked, but I only like okra in specific ways.
Fair enough.
I do like okra.
Diplomatic.
A lot, but I like it in specific ways.
It's a tough hang at times. Just going to say that.
And I appreciate that people love it. People love it for all the reasons that I don't love it, but sometimes I'm just like,
Yep.
But I respect it.
Appreciate that.
It's not the worst vegetable.
The best dessert.
You know what's really funny? I fully own and embrace that I think if I could only have one dessert, it would be tiramisu.
Oh, yeah.
Because I grew up in New Jersey and we had access to a Costco. Like that, like giant slab,
oh, yeah.
You know, baking tray of tiramisu you get out at, you know, it.
Costco bakery is the best. Your favorite cookbook of all time?
This is not my favorite one, but this is like a seminal cookbook in my life was the Dean and DeLuca cookbook.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
It's like a trillion pages,
yeah.
not a picture in the book. Barely white space. It's just like recipe after recipe after recipe. But I remember, I don't know how I got it. Somehow I got it. I remember reading it when I was like in college. And this was like, look, this was a long time ago. This is not like when like young people read cookbooks. So it's certainly not like cool young people read cookbooks. Like, and not that I was cool. I was young. But I just remember somehow like I got my hands on this thing and I started reading it. And like, it was just like such an incredible immersion into like all these like bougie foods I'd never seen in real life, like olives.
Yeah, olives.
You know,
truly.
Capers. Yeah, I didn't grow up in a house where we had olives and capers. But I just remember like learning about all these foods that were like, you know, fancy, cool, sort of bougie foods in the 80s. And yeah.
I love the story of Dean DeLuca. David Camp writes about it in United States of Arugula. We talked about it on a previous episode. Great call.
Yeah.
A couple more. Your favorite city outside America to visit for food?
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I have personal connection.
Your family, yeah.
Love the cuisine.
A couple more. A cuisine you would like to learn more about?
You know what I would say is I have a little bit of a handle on a number of different like West African traditions and cuisines, and they're so freaking good. I mean, so much of American food is actually, you know, direct line to West Africa. Like so many American, you know, I did my little mea culpa about okra, but okra is, you know, native to Africa. So like its prevalence in the South is entirely because of African, you know, enslaved Africans who came here, but also like peas and rice, like they exist in this country because of Africans. So like West African cuisine, I'm super, super, super interested in and would love to learn more about, but also like, I don't know anything about cuisine in East Africa, in Southern, like just across the
like
African
Ethiopia
continent.
Is that one?
A little bit, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been to Ethiopian restaurants, I guess.
Right, right,
like
right.
I don't know much about
no,
the cuisine.
East is, Somalia, East, you know.
Yeah, I want to learn much more about the cuisines of the African continent.
Last one, your favorite sandwich.
Oh, okay.
you've been such a sport.
I am like a pretty much equal opportunity sandwich lover. I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Cuddy's in Brookline, Massachusetts, who I think might be the best sandwich shop in the country. And anything they will make,
anything
you should eat.
I love it, Francis. Thank you so much for joining. This is Taste. It's been really fun talking to you.
It's always a pleasure, man.
This is Taste is hosted by Eliza Abarbanel and me, Matt Rodbard. The show is produced by Shalia Harris and Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for updates on all cool things that are happening.